You're listening to ABC Radio National's MP3 and podcast of The Media Report. Find out more, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to The Media Report for the 20th of October. I'm Stephen Crittenden, sitting in for Richard Adie over the next 4 weeks.
Two reporters from Melbourne's Herald Sun newspaper have refused directions from a county court judge to reveal their source for a story they published last year.
Well, that's the familiar sound of the PM program back in August. The two Herald Sun journalists are Michael Harvey and Jared McManus, and last week they were charged with contempt by the Chief Judge of the Victorian County Court, Michael Rezines. The contempt charges are due to be heard in early November, and the two journalists could face jail. On August 23rd, Michael Harvey and Jared McManus refused to reveal their sources in a criminal case against a public servant. The case involves a leaked story about a decision by the Howard Cabinet to knock back a recommendation to increase entitlements to Australian veterans. Well, the chairman of the Australian Press Council is Professor Ken McKinnon. Ken McKinnon says the decision to charge the two journalists is regrettable. In fact, he says Philip Ruddock has a responsibility to clear up a mess he has made. I wanted to know what the principle is that's at stake.
Well, the principle at stake is not to charge and put in jeopardy the messenger. Journalists are doing their job of getting to the public information that the public has a right to know about what their government is doing, and it wouldn't be available unless they got it and published it as they did.
And so if the government's got a problem with one of its public servants leaking information, that's an internal matter for the government.
Well, yes, I mean, I have no quarrel with the government chasing its own employees, but they should not do this through journalists who are simply doing their job.
You say that having placed a Victorian County Court judge in an untenable position, the Federal Attorney General, Philip Ruddock, has a responsibility to act now to clear this mess up. How?
Well, the Federal Attorney General is pursuing the case. He issued a press release expressing sympathy for the journalists, but it's his agents, his legal team, that are pursuing the journalists. And the only way that it can, in fact, be taken away, as far as I can see, is if he doesn't do that. Once it got to the court and the forcing by the prosecuting lawyers to say to the judge, are you going to allow these people to defy the court, then the judge has no other option but to proceed with a contempt action, and only the Attorney General can do something about this.
In recent months, the Australian Law Reform Commission has been holding a review of the Evidence Act. And one of the issues it's been canvassing is that journalists and presumably other professionals like doctors and lawyers and so on, whose relationships with their clients depend on a certain degree of confidentiality, should be afforded some kind of limited discretionary privilege under the law. Did the Press Council make a submission to that inquiry?
Yes, our view is that the proposition, which is that Section 22 of the New South Wales law be adopted Australia-wide, is a step forward but not in itself enough, because that section allows a judge to afford to a journalist some protection of sources but doesn't require it. Whereas in New Zealand there is an act which says that in all normal circumstances, judges are required to protect the confidentiality of sources and can only, under certain limited specified conditions, go away from that principle. And we think that the only three would be national security, personal injury, or a case like a murder case where the liberty of a person might be at stake.
Well, I'll come to those in a moment, but would you agree that these are not times when there's much sympathy for journalists? These are times, because of the terrorist threat, when governments are more inclined to be restricting our freedoms. Is it realistic to think that the Howard government is suddenly going to turn around and become a champion of press freedom?
I wouldn't agree that there is a lack of sympathy for journalists. I think the public is getting increasingly concerned about the way in which information is withheld from them. and the journalist perform a crucial middle role in getting that information out, because governments try to put spin on all information, present one side of it and so on. And as we have with the veterans cases we've seen and numerous other examples, including the Treasurer stopping freedom of information requests to get out information on BRAC creep and first homeowner scheme, and even in New South Wales, what happened about the Cross City Tunnel and the way in which traffic approaches are going to be restricted. The public will never know the main things it ought to know unless there's good investigative journalism.
You also make the point, of course, that governments of all persuasions in Australia operate day in, day out on off-the-record briefings.
Oh, well, of course. I mean, have you ever seen a straight announcement of the budget for 4 or 5 days before? Inspired leaks tell us exactly what's going to be in it, so that we've had repetition 4 or 5 times and become accustomed and so on. Now, journalists operate to make sure governments don't only do that, and they give the other side of it, so that we, the public, who are entitled to know these things as our right as citizens, have a capacity to judge the issues. Now, in the new law that's being touted about terrorism and so on, it's proposed that it's going to be debated by a committee in one day, and there'll be virtually no time to get out the story about whether it's right that we should have our civil liberties restricted in order to counter terrorism. We don't want a situation which is like the Americans had with My Lai. We had to destroy the village to save it. And we don't want to destroy our civil liberties in order to save ourselves from terrorism, which would destroy our civil liberties.
Well, let's take up this issue of national security. National security is the name of the game at the moment. The Attorney General is effectively proposing a 10-year, I guess, state of emergency with a sunset clause at the end of it in this legislation. I assume most journalists would regard their responsibility to protect their sources as absolute. That's not a responsibility that magically evaporates when the country's at war or when it's a national security issue. Now, just a moment ago, you were implying that maybe journalists shouldn't be afforded any special protection when it comes to issues like national security.
Well, I mean, it is quite clear that in preparing for countermeasures to a perceived threat, some secrecy is probably inevitable. Where we would be very concerned is if somebody is charged, as presently under the existing ASIO Act, and journalists are not allowed to know about the charging or what the charges are or what the substance is. And moreover, if it's thought that journalists have information, they can be charged in such a way that they can't disprove they have the information and are in jeopardy all the time. So those are pretty draconian laws, and what is presumed to be coming is even more draconian laws, which will restrict freedom of movement.
Indeed, and Australian journalists could find themselves facing very long jail terms indeed. What's your response to a comment made just the other day by the former head of ASIO, Sir Edward Woodward, that in cases involving national security and terrorism, it's completely acceptable for reporters to have the fear of a jail sentence hanging over their heads?
If they go too far, but what shouldn't be the case is that legally our civil liberties, we as citizens, shouldn't be at risk because there is that kind of situation under what is apparently a leaked version and to be superseded of the new Act. If anybody advocates overthrow or treats people as enemies and so on, they can be in jeopardy. We, the public, need to know about that before it's passed so that we can say to the legislators, be they Coalition or Labor, hey, it's too far. It's too big a price to pay to have that over us, even with the threat of terrorism.
Do you see any particular concerns for journalists?
Yes, the journalists will be restricted from knowing about this, from publishing anything about it, from drawing the public's attention to the way in which the law operates, and in particular about any individuals, and it's not necessarily the case that any individuals will have a fair trial as we know it, and certainly not a trial in public where the evidence can be tested. So we need to know whether those things are involved in it.
I've been watching on TV the last few weeks this amazing series on Auschwitz, And you know, there's a rather chilling thought that runs through your head under this new legislation. If the people next door to you disappear, you won't be able to talk about it.
Absolutely. I mean, it wouldn't be too much to think that it's possible. We'll get Stasi-type legislation as in East Germany. Now, I don't think it'll go that far, but I do think that in these times, the ASIO people will be pressing stuff that makes it easy for them, and that shouldn't be the case, that in a country that prides itself on civil liberties, it should be difficult for the security people to prove something, and it should be difficult to take away anybody's civil rights.
I just want to come back to the case of Harvey and McManus again, just in closing. Richard Ackland made some very interesting comments, perhaps rather cynical comments, the other day in an article he wrote. He asked, why should journalists receive the benefit of laws privileging confidentiality of their sources? Why should journalists do secret deals to protect unworthy sources at all? Now, that may be cynical, but he's actually asking some fundamental questions there too.
There certainly is an ethical issue for journalists in just receiving and not testing information, and journalists should be under very strong pressure from their editors to establish that they have credible sources and that they've tested them. For the same reasons they have to do this in defamation cases. You can't ruin somebody's reputation just because you happen to have a good lurid story. But in this world, it is important that we, the public, get what we are entitled to have, which is the full story, and we won't get it unless we can have investigative journalists who are chasing the sources. And the most of those sources are probably under threat of dismissal or other sanction. So it's important that we do help them get the story to us, not because we believe journalists should be protected in some ways, devil take the hindmost with them, but because we want to protect our flow of information, which makes us a civilised, democratic country.
It strikes me that Ackland raises an interesting philosophical issue. You know, in the United States earlier this year, Newsweek magazine announced that it would stop the practice of quoting unnamed sources in stories altogether. The 2005 annual report on the state of the news media by the Project for Excellence in Journalism suggests that news organisations are facing a new climate. The era of trust me journalism is over, and the era of show me journalism has begun. That journalists are going to increasingly be forced to move from being gatekeepers to being authenticators or referees, and they're going to have to become more transparent in their practices. Got any views about that?
Yes, we're in a state of transition. This particular point you're making was raised by the White House recently about the need to do this, and so the response of the news organisations was to say, oh, fine, well, OK, well, we'll never have any more off-the-record briefings from the White House. And the White House said, oh, no, no, we can't have that. And so it was a standoff. But from the journalist's point of view, there are two conflicting demands. One, authenticate and prove, and the other one, get the information out so that all sides of any particular story can be available. And if you can't do it with authentication of every named source, somehow the information, you can't simply wash your hands at that point and say, no more, won't report anything. Their obligation to the public is to actually keep getting that story and doing their best to authenticate it. Now, that State of the Media report has now got a chapter in it, which we are planning to do exactly the same here in Australia, of examining the content of newspapers, the degree to which stories on the front page and in the newspapers are authenticated, and the degree to which both sides or all sides of a story are told, and so on, so that the need to establish the credentials, so to speak, of the reporting industry is there, and we accept that that's got to be done, and we keep talking to editors about the need to do that.
Well, just finally, what are your feelings about this move from journalist as gatekeeper to journalist as authenticator? Is where we're moving actually a better place to be for everybody, for the whole community, or not?
Well, I can only answer that question by going at it obliquely. There is another trend, that is, that the front page doesn't always simply report dryly the facts. So you go to the next stage, which is to put some context. And the next stage after that is to put journalist opinion into the story so that it appears as news when in fact it's a mixture of fact and opinion. That, we feel, is a very insidious trend, very difficult to stop, because the newspapers feel that it's very difficult for them to keep up with the electronic press in breaking stories, so they have a responsibility to put some context around it. The best you can do with that, I think, is really keep reminding newspapers of the importance of getting the facts in front of the public and letting the readers make up their mind. And we do accept that in doing that, there's some need to put context. Just where that stops is really difficult to second-guess editors.
Thank you very much for being on the program.
It's a pleasure.
The chairman of the Australian Press Council, Professor Ken McKinnon. And on ABC Radio National, this is the Media Report. Well, as we heard, the Australian Law Reform Commission is holding an inquiry into Uniform Evidence Acts at present. And the person responsible for leading that inquiry is Associate Professor Les McCrimmon of Sydney University Law School. He's also a member of the Australian Law Reform Commission. A discussion paper was released for public comment earlier this year, and the commission is due to report to the government in December. So, how closely is the commission following the case of journalists Michael Harvey and Jared McManus?
We are following it. The issues that arise in the case do arise also in the matters that we're looking at in our discussion paper and we'll be addressing in our final report, which we are to submit to the Commonwealth Attorney General on the 5th of December.
Under the Evidence Act as it exists at present, who is protected, if anybody? What classes of people when it comes to this issue of confidential professional client information?
Stephen, it really depends on which jurisdiction you're talking about. In the Uniform Evidence Act jurisdictions, that covers the Commonwealth, New South Wales, Tasmania, and Norfolk Island. And it varies in those jurisdictions in relation to this matter. If you're in New South Wales, they have what's called a professional confidential relationships privilege, which would be a qualified privilege which would cover confidential relationships. So a journalist and the source would fall within that. If it's Commonwealth legislation at present, it doesn't contain that sort of protection, nor does the Tasmanian legislation.
Are, for example, priests or doctors or lawyers currently covered in any jurisdiction?
Priests and penitent would be covered under Section 127 of the Evidence Act, which would apply in all the jurisdictions that I've just indicated. Doctors, again, it depends on the jurisdiction. Tasmania, for example, has a privilege in relation to medical communications in a civil case, and so it really does depend on the jurisdiction you're talking about. It's certainly not uniform across Australia. My comments are just focusing on the Uniform Evidence Act jurisdictions, not the jurisdictions that are not yet a part of the Uniform Evidence Act regime.
Okay, Professor McKinnon, let's move on to what are the proposals, the options that are being outlined in this area in the discussion paper released so far?
The proposals are that the Uniform Evidence Acts adopt the New South Wales approach to the professional confidential relationships privilege. So that's a qualified privilege where if a claim for privilege is made, the judge would look at the circumstances of the particular case, the harm to the relationship, and whether the communication occurred when the person to whom the communication was made was acting in a professional capacity.
And this would be at the discretion of the judge. It wouldn't be an assumption that the right existed ordinarily.
It would be a statutory privilege as provided for under the Act. The judge, it wouldn't be an absolute privilege. For example, it's not an absolute privilege like client legal privilege or the religious confession privilege, which is currently in the Uniform Evidence Act. So it would be a privilege that the judge would make a determination based on the harm to the relationship versus the probative value of the evidence in that particular case. So it's a discretion.
What are the chances, do you think, in the current political climate with all of the concerns and legislation about terrorism, that the federal government would support any proposal to extend this kind of limited professional client privilege?
That's not really a question for me. That's a question you'd have to ask the federal government. Our proposals are contained in the discussion paper, and we'll be making recommendations in our final report. Where that goes will be up to the particular jurisdictions. It's important to note that the current report is a joint discussion paper which has been issued by the Australian Law Reform Commission, the Victorian Law Reform Commission, and the New South Wales Law Reform Commission.
Isn't it true that the Law Reform Commission made a similar recommendation to this about 10 years ago, and that was ignored?
That's correct. I don't know if ignored is the right word. It didn't find its way into the Uniform Evidence Act. It was recommended by the ALRC in its original evidence inquiry in the 80s, but didn't find its way into the report, so that's correct.
Thanks very much for being on the program.
Okay, thank you, Stephen.
Associate Professor Les McCrimmon of the Australian Law Reform Commission, and on ABC Radio National, this is the Media Report. Well, last week on the Media Report, we heard about Australia's digital television future, or lack of it. And this week, Communications Minister Helen Coonan has finally unveiled the government's plans for digital radio in this country. Sounding a bit bored by the whole idea, Helen Coonan indicated that she sees digital radio as supplementing rather than replacing analogue broadcasting, at least at this stage. It also seems that the digital broadcasting we're going to get will adopt a relatively old compression standard known as Eureka 147, which is going to limit what some broadcasters are able to provide on top of their existing services. Russell Stendall is the ABC's head of radio development, and he's talking here to Jackie May.
The main thing that it's done is that it has actually mandated the Eureka 147 standard, which is the European standard, which has been proved both technically and commercially successful in Britain particularly. And it has also mandated that all existing players, national, commercial and wide area community players, can also all migrate to digital, which is good news. The one thing that is a bit of a surprise, I think, to some people was that everybody in the industry was seeking to get what's known as a fifth of a multiplex, because all of the signals are multiplexed together on the one transmitter. And to be honest, there was no way that everybody, all three sectors in the major capitals anyway, could fit in the available spectrum. And so the minister has mandated a tenth of a multiplex each, which is one way around the problem. At the moment, the statement envisages the ABC and the SBS sharing a multiplex, and if that were the case, at a tenth of a multiplex each, we would have a bit of difficulty, I think, in offering all our current services, the five analogue services that we currently have: local radio, Radio National, News Radio, Classic FM and Triple J. We'd have trouble offering all of those in digital, as well as providing new services, which is what we're keen to do. Services such as jazz music station, a country music station, for example, sport. They're the sorts of areas that we've been looking at, the sorts of things where the ABC has got a bit of a track record and a bit of strength and expertise. And that's what we're keen to do. Our abilities to do that, I think, while sharing a multiplex with SBS, will be fairly circumscribed. But we're hopeful that over time, with the adoption of better compression ratios, that we will be able to do that.
Now, let's just backtrack a bit then. So the spectrum is to be provided free of charge to broadcasters?
Yes.
What's the incentive then to get people to take up the technology?
Well, in our view, the ABC's view, it's new and compelling content. That has certainly been the case in Britain, where, for example, to take the BBC, for example, they had five analogue services. They offer all of those analogue services on digital, plus another five or six services as well. Like BBC 7 is a 24-hour station devoted to book readings, dramas, plays, comedies, that sort of stuff. BBC One Extra is a station that targets urban black youth. There's an Asian network, all of those sorts of things. And that has been an extremely successful proposition in Britain. There are now over 2 million digital receivers in Britain, and the take-up has really been quite good. Our view is that unless you actually do offer new services like that, your chances of uptake are fairly low. Depending on the bit rate that you broadcast at, you can actually get much better audio quality, but our view is that audio quality alone is not going to be a big enough an attraction. The other thing about it, though, is that you can also provide additional information via screens, small screens, such as the name of the track that's currently playing, for example, or news headlines or weather information. And as screens become more advanced, that will go from just being text information to web images or, you know, screenshots.
And the frequency information isn't as important anymore. You actually find a station by name?
Absolutely. You tune by station name rather than by frequency, which is another great attraction of the service.
What's the time frame then?
The planning, I think, in terms of spectrum planning for this, I think, anticipates about another 2 years before the planning would be complete.
So there's nothing really to make me rush out and buy a digital radio receiver for $100 plus at the moment, then?
Not just at the moment, but hopefully in the next 2 years' time when the rollout starts happening, then you'd be mad not to be in it.
And I understand there's a quite limited range of digital receivers available here at the moment?
In Australia, they're all imported. I mean, you can't actually go to a shop and buy one. Just off the shelf, they need to be ordered in. But in Britain, for example, there are 200 different models available, all different sorts, handheld through to hi-fi systems, the main ones being your sort of standard shelf-top radio.
Now, commercial radio has, of course, been lobbying extensively, and they've had a win with the decision not to allow any new market players for 6 years, mm-hmm. and that's pretty good for the ABC as well, really. But surely opening up the spectrum calls for new entrants to generate that content that you're saying is so important.
Well, look, I mean, the entrance of new players or not is not really a matter for the ABC to either care about or comment on. What we are a great believer in is diversity of content on air. If that is best served by new players, which you could argue it isn't always necessarily the case. If you've just spent $155 million on a new license, you're probably not going to do something terribly different that's only going to appeal to a minority audience. You're probably going to take the market leader head on. Or whether it's actually provided by current players, it's really not a matter for us to comment on.
So as far as the ABC is concerned, the equity and diversity issues have been addressed by allowing free spectrum to all the players that are there at the moment.
Yeah. Well, in our view, I mean, the current players, I think, are reasonably well placed to provide new services if they so wish. It is our view that it's new services that will attract audiences to digital radio, and that's really what we're really keen on doing.
So in summary, though, slight disappointment in that the multiplex will be shared with SBS?
Yes, with the current spectrum constraints, our ability to do that is limited, and we're hopeful that technology advances over the next couple of years will resolve that for us.
And we should also mention that this is really a rollout in metropolitan areas at this stage.
Yes, with the limited spectrum available, it is actually quite difficult to broadcast in the main metropolitan areas and then the adjacent regional areas as well because of interference issues. And so, yes, there will need to be some further spectrum allocated to enable a further rollout in regional areas, is my understanding of it.
So we should expect to probably see and hear a fairly extensive public education campaign sometime soon?
Yeah, over the next couple of years, I think we'll become more and more public about it, yeah.
Russell Stendel, the ABC's Head of Radio Development. And that's it for the Media Report. My thanks to the production team, Jackie May and John Diamond, and I'm Stephen Crittenden.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcasts.